So this Christmas, I learned a new word.
I did.
It's called retconning. I'll give you something better. I'll tell you where I learned it. And you have to promise, though, you can't judge me. You cannot judge me. All right, no promises? All right. I learned it playing for the very first time Dungeons and Dragons. Dungeons and Dragons. Did not know this was going to be happening. Did not know I was going to be playing Dungeons and Dragons. Did not really know anything about Dungeons and Dragons except that it's this role-playing game. But I come to find out it's one of these key elements within the game is retconning. R-E-T-C-O-N-N-I-N-G. Or in short, to retcon. Now you might be wondering, what in the world is retconning? All right, it's short for this. To engage in retroactive continuity. Retroactive continuity, retcon. Seems pretty fancy, right? All right, retconning is what happens when you try to explain something in the present, like an anomaly or a discrepancy of some kind, something that doesn't work out just right. All right, you try to explain this by explaining something else in the past. So you're trying to make sense of something in the present by re-explaining the past, we might say. Retconning is what happens when you explain that anomaly or that discrepancy by reinterpreting another event or a series of events of the past. I'll give you an example, all right? Star Wars. All right, and by the way, if you're like, wait, Jason, I haven't seen the new one, you're going to blow this for it. I'm not blowing anything for you. We're not talking about the new one. We're going to talk about the very first Star Wars, all right, the original. All right, did you know that Darth Vader was not always supposed to be Luke's father? In some alternate universe, there was a time when we would not have the iconic phrase, Luke, I am your father. There was a time when we wanted to have that. This is world-changing stuff, all right? Without retconning, we would not have that, and we would be poorer as a culture, all right? So retconning is this. All right, so Darth Vader wasn't always supposed to be Luke's long-lost father. He wasn't. So apparently in the first movie, when Obi-Wan Kenobi tells Luke Skywalker that Darth Vader betrayed and murdered his father, we were supposed to take it literally. Until George Lucas, who authored and created Star Wars, decided in between that first movie and the second movie, that wasn't going to work, and he just threw the two characters together, Darth Vader and Luke's father, which by the third movie, if you remember this, I know I'm skipping over like years of your life and things like this, but by the third movie, you get this awkward conversation between Luke and a ghostly blue Obi-Wan Kenobi who's come back from the Force death or something like this, and Luke goes, why didn't you tell me that Darth Vader was my father? And Obi-Wan goes, well, you see, what I said was true, because when the dark side of the Force took over Anakin Skywalker, your father, it killed him. It betrayed him and murdered him, and what we got with Darth Vader. So from a certain point of view, I was right. That's retconning. All right, that's George Lucas going, oh, I said that in the first movie. What am I going to do now? I'm going to make this really strangely awkward scenario to where it's like, from a certain point of view, you know I'm right, right? All right, so that's retconning. All right, so there's that. There's that. That's retconning. That's what I learned. It has a point, I promise. So when you think about it, we do this sort of thing, we retcon all the time. All the time. And we're not the first people to do this. I think this is like part of what it means to remember things, okay? I'll give you another example in real life. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. This first verse in the Gospel of John, really the whole book, is one of the greatest examples of retconning that we have in the world. It's reinterpreting the past. It's reinterpreting. John takes those first words of the Old Testament, Genesis 1, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, and he throws Jesus back into it. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. It's John's attempt to make sense of what the earliest Christians had experienced when this Jesus guy lived and walked and died among them and then rose again. Nothing in John's past, all right, nothing in his culture would have ever allowed for him to say such a thing, all right, nothing. But if Jesus, John's saying, if Jesus is the guy that we saw, if Jesus is the one that said these things and did those things, then there's only one explanation, John said. There's only one explanation for that. And it must be that Jesus is God. Must be. So he retcons the past. So put yourselves in John's shoes for a little bit to kind of get what's really going on here, all right? John was a first century Palestinian Jew, all right? This was a guy, a Jew, who lived right there in the heart of what we today call the Holy Land, all right? And all good Jews at that time believed, and they had for a very long time, that God and God alone was one. All right? That's why they recited what we call the Shema every morning. It's this great creed of Judaism. The Lord is our God, the Lord alone. The Lord is our God, the Lord alone. John is one of these Jews, these Palestinian Jews, and he's writing to other folks, other Jews, just like him. The point is, he wouldn't have had the most receptive of an audience for what he was about to say. I'll give you an example why from modern day. A few years ago, when I was teaching up at the University of Dayton, I was teaching an introduction to religion course to a mixed group of students. About half of them were Christian, and the other half were Muslim from Saudi Arabia and Kuwait. And we were talking about this idea, this central Christian belief that Jesus is God, but that also Jesus is not equated with the Father, but the Son and the Father, and then you add in the Spirit here are three different things, but they're all one God. And I asked him a question after talking to this. I was like, what does that make you think? You know, how does that make you feel? I asked him if they had any problems with this idea. If they thought it might be strange to call Jesus God and yet say he was also different from this other God that Christians call Father. And guess what? You know what my Christian students said? Nothing. They had no problem with it. No problem at all. This was just par for the course. Normal conversation. It made sense. Of course a human can be God. Of course there can be three in one, this Trinity stuff. That's old news. My Muslim students, on the other hand, were scandalized. They were like, no, that's impossible. Don't you see the creator of all things can't be the creature too? It doesn't work that way. And worse, they said, worse, it's blasphemous. You're saying that God is human? God is human? God can, what, fail? Can't happen. That's lowering God down. It's blasphemy, they would say. It's to reduce God to something that God's not. In John's day, the people that he's writing, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God, they're more like my Muslim students. That's how they would have heard it, as scandalous, as impossible, as blasphemous. They would have thought the very idea of Jesus being God was ridiculous. And not just ridiculous, but completely and totally unorthodox. And yet, this is what John is trying to say. Listen to the next few verses from that perspective of the first century Palestinian Jew. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things came into being through him. And without him, not one thing came into being. What has come into being in him was life, and the life was the light of all people. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness did not overcome it. Now skip down to verse 14, and it continues. The Word became flesh and lived among us, and we have seen his glory, the glory as of a Father's only Son, full of grace and truth. From his fullness we have all received grace upon grace. The law indeed was given through Moses. Grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. No one has ever seen God. It is God, the only Son, who is close to the Father's heart, who has made him known. Let me repeat that. It is God, the only Son, who is close to the Father's heart, who has made him known. If you're a first century Palestinian Jew, reading or hearing this first chapter of John's Gospel, by now you have no doubt as to what John is trying to say. All right? He's saying that this very human Jesus, this one who lived and died, is none other than the Son of God. None other than God himself, the giver of all grace and truth, the one who wasn't just at the beginning of creation with God, but is God. Somehow. All right? Friends, there's, if you're hearing this at that time, there's no bigger bombshell than that. No bigger bombshell of a book than that. This is the expose of exposés, all right? If it was written today, it'd either be ridiculed and put in the tabloid section of your Kroger, or it'd be given the Pulitzer Prize. That's the status of this thing, all right? John's uncovering the identity of the creator of the universe, and he's saying that it's the guy next door. That the creator of the universe became human and died. That's crazy. But maybe the craziest part of all is that a lot of people actually believed him. They believed him. You see, when Copernicus and Galileo dared to suggest that the Earth wasn't at the center of the solar system, it took a long time for the world to catch on. All right? The idea was met with outright disdain at the beginning. Galileo was thrown into jail. All right? He was made to recant. This sort of stuff is happening here. All right? And this is just about the Earth being at the center of the universe, all right, or not, right? And so, another example. When Howard Tinman argued in the 1970s, this one's a little closer to home, he argued that he was arguing into this sphere of science and research that said that there was, okay, put it this way, there's a central dogma of molecular biology, and he was saying it was wrong. He was saying it was wrong. The central dogma of molecular biology was this, that viruses only work in one direction. That what they do is when they come into your body, they basically take the driver's seat for your cells and they take over the cells, but they don't become the cells themselves. All right? They force the cells to create more viruses. All right? Howard Tinman, however, said that that's not absolutely correct, which went against all of the molecular biology at the time. He said, there's a different kind of virus, a virus we call a retrovirus, and it's able to actually change the very DNA of your cells just like a cancer will. Nobody believed him. He would go to conferences, and they would just sort of like metaphorically throw tomatoes at the guy, all right? Wouldn't listen until finally he discovered enough evidence and threw them into labs and that they could not ignore it. And now we have retroviruses, which thankfully we do, because we didn't have Howard Tinman and his discovery of retroviruses, we wouldn't be able to treat the most common retrovirus that you've heard of, which is HIV. Howard Tinman, but it took a lot to get there. It took Copernicus and Galileo and Tinman years to convince folks that they were right. It took a lot of arguing, a lot of research, quite honestly, a lot of sheer willpower to do so. The point is, it didn't happen overnight. There are still folks who disagree. My sister-in-law works with somebody who is a geocentrist. The sun moves around the earth instead of the earth moving around the sun. All right. And so They're still there, right? So we could say the same thing with John's big revelation. Here's the point, right? We could say the same thing with what John is doing here in John 1 about Jesus being God. Christianity's core belief, the central dogma, we might say, of the faith is that Jesus is God. And not just God, but God, God, all right? That's why we're called Christians. It's the main thing that distinguishes us from Jews and Muslims and pretty much every other religion. We believe that this human being named Jesus was there in the beginning when God created the heavens and the earth. And because this human being named Jesus is God, he could defeat sin and death and evil by dying on a cross and rising again. That's the core dogma, doctrine of the faith. But we often forget that it didn't just pop out of nowhere. Just like with Copernicus and Galileo and Timon, all of this was a process. It took years, centuries, actually, to work out the details. And these guys were dealing with, Galileo and Timon were dealing with relatively hard facts that could be physically and repeatedly observed. But our core belief about God and Jesus, even in John's day, you couldn't observe that. You couldn't. In fact, it took centuries and really a whole lot of political muscle to nail down just what it meant to say that Jesus is God. So if John is writing in the end of the first century around the year 80 or 90 or something like this, in 325, get that. That's like, what? I have to do math. 200 and something years later, right? And so if he's writing at this time, then 200 and something years later, they finally start to talk about what does he mean? What does he mean? That's a long time. It's a really long time, all right? Finally starts to talk about what he's mean. The way he does this is an emperor of Rome, not even a Christian at the time, comes in and says, I think Christianity is going to be the glue that keeps the Roman Empire together. And so he calls a whole bunch of Christian theologians together and says, you guys got to come together and be unified on this idea about Jesus. And so politics brings these folks together, and they come together and they hash it out. But it takes them about 150 years to really figure it out. And by the time they really figure it out, at a whole nother conference, at a whole nother year, in a different century, under a new emperor, with a whole different people, by the time they figure it out, here's what they decide. That Jesus has got to be God, but that's about all we can say, because we just don't know anymore. Can't figure it out. Something's happening here, all right? The point is that the debates that started that day when John said that Jesus is God, the points that started that day didn't end, right? They didn't end. We tend to forget that most of the core beliefs that we hold so dearly don't just appear out of nowhere, all right? They develop. They take time, long, arduous periods of time. When John writes that the Word was in the beginning and the Word was with God and the Word was God, he didn't nail things down right then and there. He started a debate. He started a debate that would continue to rage on for centuries, In fact, John no doubt didn't have a very good picture of everything that he was saying either. All he knew was that he couldn't deny that Jesus was God. Nothing else made sense to him. Only this. That's why he emphasizes in verse 14 that the reason he's bucking the trend and going against all these traditionally held beliefs about God is precisely because he says what? He's seen Jesus' glory, the glory as of a Father's only Son, one full of grace and truth. That's what he knew. But the intricate details, the ideas about Jesus' divinity and what would become the Trinity and everything that Christian doctrine would claim for centuries, John had no clue. He just knew that somehow Jesus was God. You might be wondering, what in the world is happening? Why is Jason talking about this at the new year and Epiphany? And I'll tell you. It's because what John is doing here is not just trying to tell us who God is. He's not just trying to tell us that Jesus is God. John's trying to tell us how this Christian life of ours works. He's telling us how we can come to know God better. All right? And just as importantly, John is telling us how we can navigate this crazy world of ours with all these differing opinions, all these strange and various beliefs that people hold, how we can navigate this world in a way that is both Christ-like and honest. Christ-like and honest. All right. In short, John is telling us that knowing God takes time. It takes time. He's telling us that this Christian thing that we do here is a process. In fact, he's saying that we don't have to know everything. We don't. We don't have to know everything, and that sometimes, and get this, sometimes, John's saying, sometimes we should be happy to be wrong. We should be happy to be wrong. Why? Because some of the most important discoveries and some of the most important truths about God and about ourselves and about our world, these truths only come through lots of hard work and honest discussion, and ultimately, and here's the key, ultimately being open to the impossible, the scandalous. All right? Like God showing up in human form, like him becoming flesh, living among us. That's the Christian life. One of my favorite authors, Marilynne Robinson, would describe what John is doing here as what she calls cultivating uncertainty. She says that the heart of the Christian life is cultivating uncertainty. Cultivating uncertainty. Cultivating uncertainty doesn't mean that we give in to relativism or even that we blindly accept that everyone has their own opinions, so you're good to go. All right, or anything like this. Cultivating uncertainty means this, that we live our lives humbly. It means that we're open to being taught. And even that we're open to being corrected, because that means we're open to truth. To truth. To me, that's a remarkably freeing concept. It takes a lot of the weight off, all right? Because I know I'm probably not right in everything. And if I have to be right in everything, then I'm just scrambling at straws. I'm usually making things up, all right? I'm using big words knowing that it's going to confuse people, which is not totally true, except for maybe with retconning, all right? But it's freeing. The weight comes off because I don't know everything, right? And I don't have to because it's not on me. It's not all on me. Belief isn't about having all the answers. It's about experiencing something and realizing that if that's true, then some other stuff has to be true too, even if that means rethinking what I've previously thought. It's being open to change. It's being open, in short, John is telling us, to God acting in the world. To say that Jesus, as John does, is the source of all truth and grace and that he is the only one who is close to the Father's heart, and so the only one who really knows God, that's a humbling position for us to take, to say. Why? Because it carries with it this expectation that we don't know everything, that we can't know everything on our own. But for me, that's comforting. I think that has a lot of potential, actually. Potential for me, because it means that I don't have to carry all that weight myself. God's got this. I don't have to have it. God's got it. And if John's right about God becoming flesh and dwelling among us, then it means that God is right here with us, guiding us along the way. The Bible will call that the Holy Spirit, guiding us along the way. We say that the reason we were able to get to this whole Trinitarian doctrine thing hundreds of years later is because, not because people were particularly smart, but because God was in it, moving, guiding. And that God still does. So as we turn the page to turn the page on 2019 and remember everything that 2020 has to bring, I encourage you not to be afraid of the uncertainty. Instead, cultivate it a little bit. Cultivate it a little bit. Lean into the uncertainty, we might say. This year's an election year. This upcoming months, we have a fun time that we today call impeachment. All right, I mentioned this stuff because this means that we're going to continue on in this business of having very strongly held opinions to where it seems more important to some of us to be right than to seek truth. And that goes for every side. But what John is calling us to, what Christianity is calling us to, is not towards being right, but towards truth. towards being open to what God has to do, even if sometimes it could be ridiculous, impossible, to us. So everything about this year to me screams uncertainty and anxiety, but it also screams something else. It screams that potentiality. Uncertainty can be not just frightening, it can also be enjoyed. Uncertainty can be enjoyed as opportunity, as a chance to be something better, to do something better, to join in with something new, that God is working in the world, and we can jump on the boat. All right, so this year, 2020, I encourage you to lean into the uncertainty that is coming and work in it. Work in it. Trust that God is working with us to guide us as his people, as his church, to make a better world. To make a better world. And then enjoy it. It's not always going to be easy. It never was. But God is, if God's really here with us, if God's really Emmanuel, then we've got to be open to the impossible. And hopefully in the midst of uncertainty, the one certainty we can have is that God's right here, guiding us the whole way. Amen.